Okay, good morning, everybody. So we're here today to talk about the Great Hurricane of 1938. How many remember it?
I don't believe it.
I don't know. I think we should have checked ID at the door. But this is our normal vision group meeting, but John Horrigan was here actually last week, and he spoke about the history of the economic crisis in the United States. But I think today the topic is something that people can share their story with. So what we're going to do, what our format is John's going to do his presentation and then ask for your comments, John, or what you remember about the hurricane, answer any questions you have. And we're going to be serving a grilled chicken Caesar salad in about a half an hour. And if you need help with your drinks, just let us know and we'd be glad to help. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce John Horrigan for his presentation.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here at the Milton Council on Aging for the Low Vision Group and my other friends. My name is John Horrigan. I'm a New England folklorist, and basically that means that I don't have any prefix or suffix or a mortgage-sized student loan following me around. I'm a weather historian, a historical astronomer, a great fire historian, an economic historian, and I must apologize if I break out into a professional sports announcer voice. That's because I am one with the Boston Bruins alumni hockey team, and I'm actually the New England Patriots basketball announcer, but that's a lecture on another day. I'm a colonial boy of the Atlantic. I've summered in Green Harbor. Cell phones off, please. Usually when I say that, mine rings. We know where restrooms are. If there is a fire, we go out and to the left or out this door and just move away from the building. My expert rule is usually there's someone who knows more about the subject than I do and someone who thinks that they know more about the subject than I do. And in this case, I think that you folks know more about this than I do because you live through it. We're going to look at the overview of the Great Hurricane of 1938. What is a hurricane? A short history of North Atlantic hurricanes, the Great Colonial Hurricane and Great September Gale, the track and GH-38 factoids, the summer of 38, the muffed forecast, a record low air pressure. Then we're going to track the storm as it hits New York City, Long Island, Connecticut, the Great New London Fire, Rhode Island, something I call Wedding Splashers. It's a play on the movie title Wedding Crashers. The Mary Poppins of Brant Rock. The Great Flood of 36 and the battering of the Connecticut River Valley. And then we'll wrap it up with mass impact and the death of a monster. In the hurricane of 1938, and folks, don't worry if you can't see the text on the screen. Trust me, I'll drive the narrative. They'll be able to hear me in Dorchester, okay? There were acts of bravery and acts of cowardice. There were acts of kindness and acts of selfishness. We see providence, luck, and cruel fate. Up until that time, this is the most costly disaster in United States history. It's known as a lateral buzzsaw. Nobody was prepared because nobody was warned. There were unlikely heroes, and by the time it died out on September 28, 1938, 10 states and 2 countries were affected. Not to bog you down with a lot of math, but when you talk about categories of hurricanes, and they have been revised, category 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, basically a category 1 is 74 to top winds of 95 miles per hour. A category 3, which this storm was designated as, has winds between 111 and 130 mile an hour. That's sustained. And a Cat 5, Katrina-like, is winds higher than 155 miles per hour. Just so you know, a tropical depression is 23 to 39 miles per hour, and a tropical storm about 40 to 73 miles per hour. Reason why I say that, do you remember Hurricane Bob? It looked like some jet fighters took out all of Wareham along the south coast of Massachusetts. Well, that was a hiccup. That was a tropical depression, maybe a tropical storm. When you talk about terms of hurricane, you hear about storm surge. It's basically a dome of water 40 to 60 miles long that moves onto the shoreline near the landfall point of the eye of the hurricane. A cubic yard of seawater weighs approximately 1,700 pounds. as this water is constantly slamming onto shoreline structures, even well-built structures quickly get demolished. As the waters move inland, more debris floats along with it, causing further damage. Storm surge is responsible for nearly 90% of all hurricane-related deaths and injuries. 200,000 people died in India in 1876 due to storm surge in one storm. 300,000 in Haiphong, China died in 1881. Wind damage. The force of wind can quickly decimate the tree population, down power lines and utility poles, knock over signs, and may be strong enough to destroy some homes and buildings. Flying debris can also cause damage, and in cases where people are caught outdoors, injuries, and of course, death. When hurricanes first make landfall, it's common for tornadoes to form, which can cause severe localized wind damage. In most cases, however, wind is the secondary cause of damage. Storm surge is normally the primary cause. And of course, rainfall and flooding. Torrential rains that normally accompany a hurricane can cause serious flooding. Whereas the storm surge and high winds are concentrated near the eye, the rain may extend for hundreds of miles and may last for several days, affecting areas well after the hurricane has diminished. And if you look at the vulnerable American coast and the population centers, it goes basically from Portland, Maine, down to Miami. Of course, the population, the heavily populated corridor of the Northeast, extends from Boston down to Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. This is a map, and I'm not sure if you can see it, but basically it's a chart of all the hurricanes from 1886 through 1996. And you can see a determined pattern that they move to the northwest, they develop off the west coast of Africa, they go into the doldrums in the Caribbean, and then tend to head north, or they cut across the Floridian Peninsula and into the Gulf of Mexico. One of the great things about studying hurricanes is that you can look at hurricane strikes in New England that took place in antiquity. An analysis of sedimentary deposits reveal major hurricane strikes along the New England coast. We know that one happened between 1100 and 1150, medieval. 1300 to 1400. 1400 to 1450 one hit here. And of course, the three major hurricanes, or four major hurricanes, including the Hurricane of 38, were the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635, the Great September Gale of 1815, and I've added something known as Saxby's Gale of 1869. Some will argue about that. And just one thing to take into consideration. When Columbus came over and discovered the West Indies, and I'm not going to get into how that's a misnomer, he came over in October, and he was just so lucky that he didn't run into a hurricane during hurricane season, because if he did, it would have probably set back the discovery of North America by about 50 years. And we might have our heritage from Vikings as opposed to Anglo-Saxon. The Great Colonial Hurricane took place on August 16, 1635. That's the old style calendar, the Julian calendar. The calendar was moved forward in time in September of 1752. Governor John Winthrop said, quote, "It blew with such violence, with abundance of rain, that it blew down many hundreds of trees, overthrew some houses, and drove ships from their anchors. The tide rose at Narragansett 14 feet higher than ordinary and drowned 8 Indians flying from their wigwams." The ship Angel Gabriel was destroyed in the north shore of Massachusetts. 21 people were lost. We know that the eye passed to the south and east of Boston. And in Plymouth, Governor William Bradford says, "It caused the sea to swell to the south wind of this place above 20 foot right up and down and made many of the Indians to climb into trees for their safety. It continued above 5 or 6 hours, but the violence began to abate. It blew down many hundreds of thousands of trees. The signs and marks of it will remain this 100 years in these parts." So even Bradford knew that the destruction that he was witnessing during the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635 would leave its mark for another 100 years. And of course, he makes an astronomical reference when he says, "The moon suffered a great eclipse the second night after it." Then we move to the Great September Gale of 1815. It struck on Saturday, September 23rd, 1815. And Noah Webster said that the storm was a proper hurricane. One of the several severe storms that season that struck the North Atlantic shipping lanes. And it struck Long Island near Center Moriches. Montauk Point Lighthouse was heavily damaged. And in the East River in New York, wharves were underwater by 3 feet, during the morning of that great day of September 23rd, 1815. And the eye passes to the east of Hartford and Springfield. The Hampshire Gazette said that there was a tornado of wind and rain. In Yale, they received 6.5 inches of rain over 2 days. The New Haven Register, quote, says, it drifted several hogshead of rum and molasses from the wharf. Of course, that's very important. They lost their rum and molasses. And in eastern Connecticut, all of Rhode Island and east central Massachusetts were raked. Rain had a salty flavor to it. Houses and trees had white hue from the ocean froth, and it whipped 90-foot sprays from the Charles River. In fact, there's a report of a waterspout, that's a tornado in water, on the Charles River on September 23rd, 1815. My point being is that the Great Colonial Hurricane, the Great September Gale of 1815, and the Hurricane of 1938, for all intent and purpose, took the very same track up the Connecticut River Valley. Here are some major hurricanes. I'm showing a graph here. In addition to the hurricane of 38, there's the Great Atlantic Hurricane of 1944 and a hurricane of 1954. I always get confused. Is that Donna? Is that Edna? Now, an extratropical cyclone, which is what the Great Hurricane of 1938 was, is basically a cyclone or a hurricane that collapses on itself. And as the intensity diminishes, as the eye wall diminishes, the duration is prolonged. So you get more sustained rain, more sustained wind. And you can see the track. This hurricane was born off the west coast of Africa, as many, many hurricanes have been born. Tracking it, we found that the hurricane was due east by 190 miles on 8:30 a.m. on September 18th. A day later, it had only moved approximately 100 miles to the northwest. A day after that, on September 20th, it had moved slightly to the north-northwest by about 200 miles. And then this thing gets legs. This thing takes off. The following day, it moves up the coast from just off the coast of Florida to off of Cape Hatteras on the morning of September 21st. And it races to New York that afternoon. It strikes Long Island at 3:30 p.m., so this thing moved quickly, and we're going to see the details on it in a moment. It eventually died out in Montreal and went north of Montreal. So people actually north of Montreal in the section of Canada that is now Inuit actually suffered from this hurricane. So the path of the Great Hurricane, it hit Burlington, Vermont on late in the afternoon, early in the morning of the 23rd, and then it hooked north into Canada and eventually died out over the Great Lakes region. So just looking at it, and again, this is blurred, it's not your vision. It's a hurricane one on September 13th at 74 miles per hour. It was a category two on September 16th with winds of 98 miles per hour. It was a category three on September 17th with winds of 115 miles per hour. Later that day, it went to a category four on September 17th with sustained winds at 132 miles per hour. And then it hit a monster on September 19th. It was a cat five with 160 mile an hour sustained winds. Then it decreased to a category four on September 20th, sustained winds of 155 miles per hour. And then as it raced north on September 21st, it had sustained winds of 127 to 130 miles per hour. So when it hit landfall, you saw sustained winds just due south of 130 miles per hour. And then it hooked into Montreal and then hooked to the southwest and died over the Great Lakes, actually just near Erie, Pennsylvania. So the factoids. It's the most costly disaster in American history up to that year. It moved rapidly up the coast at 67 miles per hour. It moved 700 miles in 12 hours. Landfall winds, as I mentioned, 127 miles per hour, sustained at about 120 to 125, depending upon who you speak to. Top winds were 156 miles per hour. And just down the road from where we stand today at Blue Hills, they had a gust measured at 186 miles per hour. There were 40-foot storm surges in some places. And to compound the aggressiveness of the storm, it hit at high tide, and seas rose 17 feet in some places. And check this out. Salt water sprayed houses in Montpelier, Vermont, 120 miles away from the ocean. southern New England coastal areas were inundated. Most victims drowned. Some had their clothes completely blown off. The first impact of the storm surge actually registered on seismographs in Alaska. And seawater destroyed vegetation 20 miles inland. Many, many towns throughout New England had a story to tell. And just to show you the picture, we all know where the Connecticut River Valley is, just beyond Springfield. It basically tracked up that Connecticut River. What about the summer of 38? Of course, some here can tell me better than I could tell you. There was record precipitation in June and July. It was a very muggy August and a really muggy September. Between September 12th and September 15th, there was 1 inch of rain each day. The rivers were rising. On September 17th through the 20th, there was constant rain. September 20th, the heaviest rainfall. Then there was 13 inches in 5 days in the Thames River Basin in Connecticut. And some areas reported 17 inches of rain in 5 days. So what do you have? You have soft soil, weak foundations, and weak roots for trees exposed. They're just waiting to get hit. So the hurricane's impact exacerbated the effects of the summer of 38. What's going on if you picked up your newspaper that day on Wednesday, September 21st, 1938? You'd find out that the Treaty of Munich was imminent, that Chamberlain, that noodle in Britain, handed over the Sudetenland of Czechoslovakia to Hitler through annexation. Churchill, of course, protests. The Boston Red Sox beat the St. Louis Browns 8-4, but remained 11 games back in the American League. And then the Lowell Sun, their weather forecast says, quote, "The weatherman says more rain and cooler tonight and Thursday." A New York Times editorial, the irony here, on September 21st, 1938, quote, "Every year, an average of 3 such whirlwinds sweep the tropical North Atlantic between June and November. In 1938, there was an all-time record of 20. If New York and the rest of the world have been so well informed about the cyclone, it is because of an admirably organized meteorological service." So I tell football players, don't do your touchdown dance until you get into the end zone. Remember, they had no tools here. And in 1898, there was something known as the Portland Gale. I'm sure that some of you here have heard about it. The great folklorist Edward Rowe Snow was the one who chronicled that storm. But we were actually warned about that. The Weather Service did a great job, and people were actually prepared, except for the poor people on board the SS Portland were prepared for that storm. But here in Washington, they had no tools. In Washington, D.C., at the Weather Bureau, a 28-year-old rookie by the name of Charles Pierce is filling in for 2 vacationing meteorologists, and he argues that the storm would be sandwiched between 2 high-pressure systems and head directly north and cut through New England. Well, longtime veteran Charles Mitchell ignores his forecast. He says, "No hurricane has hit New Jersey during my tenure. This current storm is weakening." Wrong. What you saw were record low barometric readings, a barometric nosedive. The RM of the ship, the RMS Carinthia, had a reading of 27.85. This is the lowest in recorded history in the North Atlantic. He's off the coast of Virginia early on the morning of September 21st, 1938. This is a bad monster heading north. Fire Island in New York. Within 2 hours, it went from a low reading of 29.78 to an inconceivable low of 27.43 on the 21st of September. On September 21st, a man on West Hampton Beach in New York thought that his new barometer was broken when it measured 28. While he was at the post office sending it back, his house was blown away. On the Red Star liner Konigstein, skipper Alfred Leidig has barometer readings of 28.40 with 100-mile-per-hour winds. And then here's a story about the father of typhoons. On September 19th, Reverend Ernest Gerzi, an Italian Jesuit with 23 years of meteorological experience, while on board the Italian liner Conte di Savoia, bound for New York City, states that, quote, one of my children will be around in about 3 days. After checking his weather charts, the barometric readings, and the sky conditions. So this man knew that there was a monster of a storm out there. So it hits New York City. An average gale of 65 miles per hour, a tropical storm, and 4.5 inches of rain. The city is at a standstill from 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock. Thousands are marooned in office buildings. There's extensive flooding of streets and basements. At 8:45 at night, a power failure at Consolidated Edison left all of the Bronx and parts of Manhattan in darkness. The only death was a hitchhiker who decided to abandon the stalled car. He got in a car with this man who was driving him, and he decided to get out, and he was carried away by the current. Fort Schuyler Road, Throgs Neck, had 9-foot waters at 7:30 p.m. The storm's first heroes: J. Gilbert Finning, 40 years old. William McGrath, 30 years old. Well, during the evacuation of Fort Schuyler Road, Finning slips and falls while pushing an elderly woman in a boat. McGrath goes after him. Both perish. McGrath is posthumously awarded the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission's Bronze Medal. So this was also known as the Long Island Express. And this map basically shows the southern coast of Long Island is totally exposed to the fury of the North Atlantic. There was devastation in Long Island. Trees were hauled down, blocking roads. There were people that couldn't reach their houses for days because of the fallen trees. And there was also selfishness. Some wealthy homeowners forced their servants to remain in their mansions and cottages while they evacuated, sealing their fate. One account had a family and their friends packed into a car that drove off with their servants watching in ankle-deep rising water on their driveway. Some pets and horses were left behind to fend for themselves and subsequently drowned in the storm surge. After a tree fell on his car, a man on Long Island frantically shook a police officer, saying, "That car's brand new. Who can I sue? Who can I sue?" And there was substantial looting. In East Hampton, New York, the ground around their house became so soggy that the rain nearly took down all of their trees. In East Hampton, a devastated village in southern Long Island, Solid Square, shut down. In West Hampton, Long Island, 28 dead, 4 missing, 153 of 179 houses were destroyed. The Long Island Expressway was blocked off. Trees fell like tenpins along the highway. Bridgehampton, New York, saw devastation. Of the estimated 2 billion trees that were lost in the Northeast, 3,500 trees were lost in the Bridgehampton, Sagaponack, Hayground area alone. The elms and locusts that formed a half-mile-long arch over Main Street had been planted before the American Revolution and can still be seen in the canvases of many important artists of that period. When the storm was over, 42% of the Main Street elms were gone. Nassau, Long Island, devastated. Dune Deck, Bayside, New York. The ocean-torn inlet between West Hampton Beach and Quogue, 400 feet wide and 20 feet deep. Waves broke onto lawns 1 mile inland. 6 miles south of Bayshore, across Great South Bay, Saltaire lost 125 houses. Kismet and Fair Harbor lost 91 houses. Oak Beach lost 29 houses. There was substantial devastation and destruction in Ocean Beach and Point of Woods. And of course, Fire Island in Long Island, New York, was scoured. Over 200 homes had been perched on dunes 20 feet high on Fire Island, Long Island. The next morning, it was just a sand dune. Frederick Foster Durham, he's 54 years old and vice president of the Fulton Trust Company. The New York train that he rides on is marooned in Warwick, Rhode Island. Usually it's a 15-minute trip. On this day, it took 2 hours. He got home at 8 o'clock. As he washed up, as his wife was preparing dinner, he dropped dead from exhaustion and exposure. At Saltaire, The morning after the storm, a young blonde girl sat on a box. As the chief assistant district attorney, Lindsay Henry, arrived, the little girl asked, "Could you assist us in the search for a body?" "Of course," he said. "Whose body is it?" She shut her eyes tightly and sadly said, "My mother's." Heroes, West Hampton Police Chief Stanley Teller and Officer Tim Robinson saved 17 people. Halfway across the West Bay Bridge, they abandoned their two cruisers and waded and swam the rest of the way. They saved a helpless woman and her three children in deep water on Dune Road. They led all 17 onto the roof of a nearby house. A huge wave swept the house off of its foundation. 3 hours later, they all landed at Quogue, having crossed the bay. No lives were lost. And now here's a story I'd like to tell you called The Flight of the Burghards. George and Mabel and their fox terrier Bitsy and their cocker spaniels Peter, with their caretakers Carl and Selma Dalen, rented a cottage. It was 75 feet from the top of a 9-foot dune, 100 feet from Dune Road, and 75 feet from the Coast Guard station. The distance to the water's edge of the Burghards' cottage was 200 feet. Their neighbors had a 30-foot cabin cruiser moored to the dock between the houses. 10 a.m. that morning of the 21st, the wind is strong from the north, it's overcast, drizzle, and there's heavy seas. At 11 a.m., the wind shifts to the east, then to the northeast, at gale force. Dalen reports water bubbling through the concrete floor of the garage. He thought it was going to be fresh water from the bay, but he tastes it. It's salt water. Mabel goes upstairs and puts on her swimsuit. Noontime. The neighbor's boat is drifting. Burghard calls Chief Botswain's mate, James Ketchum, at Mauritius Coast Guard Station, 3 miles to the west of their location. Of course, Ketchum says, "I'll be right down." 1 o'clock, radio station WESF. The West Indies, quote, "The West Indies hurricane is in the mid-Atlantic." No, it's not. It's right on their doorstep in New York. The electric power at this point is still on. 1:30 p.m., their friend Bill Ottman calls and says that his garage has just been blown into the bay. At 2 o'clock, 90-mile-per-hour winds are shifting to the east. The water is now 2 feet deep in the Burghards' garage. Mabel is sewing in the sunroom with her back to the bay windows. Mrs. Dalen, the servant, tells her to change her seat. Just as she does, the window blows out with glass shards being sprayed everywhere. At 2:30 p.m., wind and rain is intensifying. Their bathhouse is swept away. At 3 o'clock, Burghard tells Dalen to pack clothes and move to the third floor. At 3:10 p.m., a wave breaks through the back door and sweeps Dalen off of his feet. At 3:30 p.m., John Avery, Coast Guard, comes across the meadow, and he says, "Let's get moving quick, people. No time to lose. Let's go." The high tide is due at 6:10 p.m. Burghard stuffs his tennis tickets for the match at Forest Hills the next day into his pocket. 4 o'clock, Mabel Burghard picks up Peter, and George picks up Bitsy, so they both get their dogs now. The Dalens are much older, and they're dilly-dallying. The wind now is up over 100 miles per hour. It's a half-mile walk to the bridge across the bay. They got to get to the bridge. Mrs. Dalen is being nearly dragged by Avery. Old Carl Dalen, clings to the fence post as they get out of the house, back in the driveway, as the group moves slowly down the road into the wind. Carl then sits down on a fence, exhausted. His head is down. He's now 75 feet behind the group. And he can't hear them call due to the wind. Mrs. Dalen is hysterical for her husband. Can you imagine that? Leaving your husband or your wife behind like that. The wind suddenly shifts to the southeast at 110 miles per hour. I don't think anybody here has ever walked in 100. You can't walk in 110 mile per hour winds, but It's exhausting. 50-foot breakers roar over the sand dunes. Flotsam drifts by in the raging sea torrents. There's a boat tied to the dock, and the group moves towards it. 4:15 p.m., with a sickening crash, the Coast Guard station hits the bay and smashes to pieces. Just then, the line snaps, and the boat, their only salvation, is dragged out to sea. Electric wires hit the ocean and puddles. Electrocution is a distinct possibility. Mrs. Dalen has now fallen 50 feet behind the group, refusing to move, calling to her husband, who is now 125 feet behind the group. The Burghards, with dogs under their arms, go out onto a broken dock and lie down. They're hoping to ride it like a surfboard. Just then, a large piece of wooden siding comes by, and Mabel, George, the dogs, and Avery, the Coast Guardman, climb onto it. The wind had driven the bay water across to the mainland with such force that for about 200 feet, the bay bottom was dry. Kind of a drawdown that would have happened during a tsunami. The Dalens now are helpless. The Burghards and Avery jump off the board and wait for the giant wave that takes them 200 feet out into the bay. 6-foot waves continually wash them off the board, and they climbed right back on. Can you imagine? You're thinking about going to the tennis match right now. You're fighting for your life hanging on to a piece of wood out in a bay. They dodge flotsam, cars, jagged glass, and boards with nails moving quickly by them. The dogs are placed on a trailer little raft behind them. Bitsy is washed off, but Peter, the other dog, grabs him by the ear and drags him back to the raft. They paddle around huge chunks of houses and debris. Ducks fly backwards at 40 miles per hour. The raft finally makes landfall, and it's grounded in berry bushes. Bitsy disappears somewhere in the brush. They land 1 mile west from their house at Onek, across the bay, and they head to higher ground at the golf course. They wave down a car and make their way into West Hampton. What does Avery do? He's done with these people. He moves off to help more people. There's that hero motif. Some of the Burghards' personal belongings are found miles away from their house. The Dalens' bodies are located. Carl was found near the golf course, and he had broken his leg. So he had actually gotten carried to where the Burghards landed. John Avery, naturally, is cited for his bravery. There's wood that is pierced through other pieces of wood like an arrow. Every street corner has an armed man looking for looters. There's 48-hour price gouging. Prices go skyrocketing. There's that selfishness motif. That awful sea smell stuck around for over a year. Quote, before and after, the gymnasium's turned into a mortuary. There's a breach at Shinnecock Inlet. Shinnecock Inlet was an isthmus, a promontory, and it's breached. The ocean actually washes over it. I look at the beach towards Gurnett Lighthouse. People familiar with that, down towards Marshfield, Duxbury, and one day that'll be breached. The Shinnecock Inlet, 1 month later, was opened by the hurricane, and it was born. Now I'll tell you about some heroes of Stony Point. The photo I have is what, for people that can see? Beavers. There were 60 colonies of beavers from the Adirondacks, and of these 500 beavers, they built 60 dams. Well, the dams in Palisades Park held back swollen rivers and ponds. These beavers worked all through the night of the 21st of September to fortify their bulwarks. Long Mountain Beaver Pond doubled in size from 5 to 10 acres due to the dam made of mud, sticks, stones, and sod. It was 150 yards long and 6 feet high, and it held fast, only spilling 18 inches of water over its top. The Cedar Hill Pond Dam doubled in size to 8 acres. It was 40 feet wide and water rose 2 feet. These beavers saved 5 arterial highways used for evacuation. Long Mountain Road, Johnstown Road, U.S. Highways 6, 17, and Route 9 West, the heroes of Stony Point. The southeast coast of Connecticut was slammed from Saybrook Point to Stonington. There are so many stories, countless stories of the hurricane of 38. One of them is a chicken farmer in Long Island who had just the day before had the poultry inspector out actually that morning, and he had banded all of his chickens to mark and brand his chickens. One of those chickens from Long Island is found in Connecticut. There's also a story that certain bugs were never found on Connecticut. They were brought over from Long Island during the hurricane. I was going to read a story about the Bostonian to you, a harrowing train ride, and again, a heroic story, but I'll give you the brief overview. I don't think we have time, and I know that we're going to be serving dinner soon, but the Bostonian was a train that was full of returning prep school students, business people, and it had 275 passengers, and you had the conductor and the engineer. Well, at 3:30, the railroads were ordered to halt, and the train fireman checked out the tracks, and he noticed that the water was rising rapidly and that they should evacuate. Well, he was overruled by the conductor, and they saw the sailboat smash onto the tracks in front of them. It was at that point, and you can see in this picture, folks, it shows the tracks of the train sagging into the water. And you know that once the rear car goes in, it pulls off the rest of the train. So what the conductor did, a man by the name of Brown, decided to evacuate all of the rear cars and bring all of the people forward. Well, they had just put out dinner in the dinner car, and these businessmen had just paid for their dinner. And we're not moving. We're going to finish our dinner. You'll get into that blankety-blank front car, or you're going to be wearing your dinner. Goes to the car behind them, and the prep school students, they're making a ruckus. They're screaming, making a noise. And he's trying to yell. They're not listening to him. He smashes the glass where the fire axe is and puts it over his shoulder. Now I got your attention. Get out of this car. Get to the front car and to the locomotive. So what they did is they moved the women and the children, oh, dozens of them, to the front locomotive. Imagine them all standing around. And then the first car behind them. And then one of his engineers dives into the water and uncouples car number two from car number three. And he manages to slowly get moving. He tried four times. And on the fourth try, I think I can. It happened. And they plowed through debris and drag wires. And several lives were saved when they finally rolled into Stonington Station. That's the quick story of the Bostonian. In Danielson, Connecticut, one of the famous photographs is of a steeple falling down. It's a 120-year-old steeple that has toppled. Now I want to talk to you about Katharine Hepburn. We're in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Well, Kate, she was considered to be box office poison because she had just auditioned for a film that was about to commence production. She just had a bust of a film, and I'll talk about that in a second. She's with her boyfriend, Red Hammond. They decide to go out and play a round of golf. They notice it was very humid and breezy. Well, on the par 3 ninth hole, Kate Hepburn scores a hole-in-one, just like Michelle Wee did the other day. She finished with her best round of golf ever with an incredible 31 she shot on 9 holes. Afterward, she and Red went for a swim in front of the house. She stated about the breezy weather and the rising surf that something very special is going to happen. Well, their family had an elegant summer house in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, and they've been there since the turn of the century. Her brother, Dick, was a screenwriter, and he's working on a script. Kate was waiting to hear back if she got the part of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. She had just finished making a terrible movie. Well, I can't call it a terrible movie, but Bringing Up Baby, which was a bust earlier in the year. Well, the water rose 17 feet high, and Dick and Catherine got the family out as two of the chimneys in the house crumbled and the guest cottage drifted about a half mile away. Family heirlooms were lost in the mud. Days later, when Kate got home to Old Saybrook, it is said that she was on her knees, some say inebriated, digging in vain for her family's jewelry, mumbling to herself as Red Hammond tugged gently on her shoulders and said, "I think it's time to leave." Of course, Dick found his typewriter and his scripts perfectly intact. They were never optioned for movies, though. The Battle of Colts Dyke, Connecticut River, Hartford. You want to talk about teamwork. 1,200 WPA workers, World War I veterans, college students, and volunteers fought to keep 1 million tons of water out of the south end of the city that was devastated by the floods of 1936. Army engineers say there's a 50-50 chance that the bulwark will hold when water crests at 28 feet. There's a plan to dynamite Clark's dike should it not hold to save the industrial area. So basically they're saying, do we save the industrial area or the residential area? And they chose to, which was the proper decision, unfortunately, to choose to save the industrial area. If you look at Provincetown, the Portland Gale of 1898, for all intent and purpose, washes Provincetown off the map as a fishing center, and it never recovers. And you'll see that what happens with New Bedford in a moment with the hurricane of 38. An arrow points to the Traveler's Insurance Tower in Hartford. The clock in the old State House stopped at 4:10 p.m. Mrs. Carl Carlson, driving towards Guilford, Connecticut, was stopped in traffic as they removed a tree from the road. She picked up a book to read. Just then, a tree came crashing down on her car, killing her instantly. She was reading the book, Gone with the Wind. The river, the Connecticut River, rose 4 inches per hour. Matt Strong caught a 5-pound bass with his bare hands on Main Street. Fred Fredsall's apple tree was blown over, and then later it was blown upright, and it yielded fruit for a few years after. In New London, there's storm surge, 110 mile per hour winds, and then a great fire breaks out. In Cheshire, Patrick Joyce is killed when he was hurled against a brick wall of a prison building. And then it hits Rhode Island. The plight of the Moore family at Watch Hill, they were washed out. 11 people, including 3 servants, crammed into an attic of a sturdy house on the edge of Little Narragansett Bay. Mr. Moore, who had suffered a heart attack that morning, manages to board up his house. The roof is ripped off and thrown into the sea. The entire family jumps into the ad hoc raft. Huge waves crash down upon them. Hammerhead sharks follow the raft. Hammerhead sharks brought up with the warm water from the Gulf. They floated clear across the peninsula. And they drifted across the bay and into a cove on Barn Island. They spent the night huddled in an abandoned barn. From their vantage point at Watch Hill, they could see the glow of the New London fire. They were rescued by lobstermen on the 22nd, and all 39 houses on Watch Hill were wiped off the face of the earth. There was a 20-mile stretch from Napatree Point to Point Judith, where 175 people were killed. If you go by Napatree Point and tell somebody that used to be filled with homes, somebody that doesn't know about it would laugh at you because it's a sand spit. There's no way you could build on that. Napatree Point, Rhode Island, before, a vibrant coastal community. The next day, it's just a spit of land. There's nobody there. The storm hit westerly Rhode Island at 3:50 p.m., 100 killed. By the way, I just want to let you know, I'm skipping the New London fire. I can get into the details of it. I'm a fire historian, but New London was burnt twice in September of 1781 by the traitor Benedict Arnold, and then again, it caught fire in 1938. A tremendous conflagration where firefighters couldn't put out the fire because of the changing winds. Westerly, storm strikes at 3:50 p.m., 100 killed. There are 194 of 200 homes destroyed in Misquamicut Beach in Rhode Island. 50 bodies are found washed up in the sand dunes. It is devastated. Misquamicut Beach, inundated. In Island Park, Rhode Island, there are 19 dead. Only 2 of 200 houses survive. The rest, 198 of them, are destroyed. The tidal marshes in Newport. In Conemaugh Beach, in Narragansett Bay, another 100 houses are destroyed. In Oakland Beach, 100 are left homeless. And a woman says, "My baby has just been blown out of my arms." Jamestown, Rhode Island, 14 people perish. Barrington. The Governor Carr Ferry crashes in Jamestown. 86 of 100 boats are destroyed on Block Island. The three things that you hear people say are, where do I go now? Everything that I own is gone. I had no insurance. The rats at Brown University, this is not a reference to the people who work in the Bursar's office. The calls began coming into a couple of local exterminators that mice had infested a women's dormitory at Brown University and that rats were seen at the library. Were they seeking higher ground at College Hill? Many cats and dogs went missing on the morning of the hurricane. Squirrels and birds were reportedly moving about in an agitated manner, according to some residents of Plymouth. In Providence, the city is a perfect funnel and aqueduct. The storm surge struck at 5:15, just as power went out and people were leaving their offices. A white wall of water rushed up Providence River. A deluge of water 13 feet high was in the city streets. The Providence River rose 17 feet in 70 minutes. Appliances and consumer goods floated down the streets from department stores. Exchange Place in Providence had a boat in the center for many weeks. The steamer Monhegan, sunken and wedged into a pier, took about a week to dislodge in Providence. Wedding splashers. Joe Fogle and Lorraine Martin were scheduled to get married on the second floor in the ballroom of the Narragansett Hotel in downtown Providence. Well, where's Joe? Cold feet? No, he's stuck at Union Station with his family. 500 refugees sought shelter from the storm in the hotel. What'd they do? They feasted on the wedding banquet and drank all of their champagne. Joe shows up at 11 o'clock that night. They're married by candlelight by an anxious minister. They took a short walk on a smelly, muddy street, the water receded by 10 o'clock in Providence, to their honeymoon suite at the Biltmore Hotel. Something I call the Mary Poppins of Brant Rock, Marshfield. A 10-year-old boy in Brant Rock, Mass., saw that the weather was getting wild late in the afternoon of September 21st, 1938. He decided to heighten the exhilaration of the storm by getting his grandfather's best umbrella out of the closet and climbing up on the roof of the garage. He jumps off the roof, thinking that he might fly. As he tumbled to the ground, the umbrella was bent and broken. He received what's known as red bottom for his poor judgment. And that boy, of course, was my dad. Just to the Massachusetts South Coast. Eyewitness to the storm surge. Quote, this is unique. You heard about, of course, you know about that tsunami in Indonesia. But to have a visual description of the storm surge coming on shore in Horseneck Beach is uncanny. 5 o'clock, Buzzards Bay. Quote, the man says, a long black band is approaching. A solid black wall of water looks like an unusually large black roller coming into the shore, with its top being blown off so that it did not curl up and break like an ordinary wave. 30-footers hit Horseneck Beach. 41 perish in Fall River. Ships, boats, and barges are torn off their moorings and docks. The oil tanker Phoenix spills its cargo and is blown across the river onto lawns. In New Bedford, 9 cotton mills are destroyed, 10,000 employees are jobless, and the New Bedford economy would never recover from the storm. The Acushnet River rises 11 feet. 1,500, and I didn't even know there were 1,500 houses in Fairhaven. They're destroyed. 1,500 are homeless. The fishing fleets are overdue. The New Bedford Standard Times, quote, women stood with babies in their arms and watched the horizon in the ageless manner of wives whose men ply the sea. Others went from boat to boat asking questions. Everywhere, the answer was a simple negative shake of the head. Westport Harbor, destroyed. New Bedford, destroyed. Woods Hole, destroyed. Wareham, inundated. Bourne Bridge, National Guardmen stand on top of a house just underneath the newly opened Bourne Bridge as they mourn the tragedy of a family that perished. Martha's Vineyard, there are 25-foot waves at Chilmark. Menemsha, bridge from Gayhead to Menemsha, washed out. There was destruction all over New England, East Brookfield, New Bedford, Springfield, East Bridgewater, Mattapoisett, Taunton, Newton, Fairhaven, Wareham, West Brookfield, Boston, Ware, Worcester, North Uxbridge, Putnam, Connecticut, downtown Boston, Arlington Street, a tree toppled, blocking the road. Massachusetts State House, tree in the lawn. The hatch shell at the Esplanade flooded out at the Charles River in Boston. Lexington Green, again, rendered a battlefield, this time, though, due to a hurricane. Exeter, New Hampshire, trees uprooted. Peterborough, New Hampshire, flooded downtown. Boston Post says 45 killed in wild hurricane, property damage in the millions, hundreds hurt by the wreckage. Boston Globe, hurricane dead, 250. Globe, wrong again. Nazi terror rain begins. 322 dead in the storm, according to the New York Daily News. Daily Record says deaths now at 390. The Herald says deaths mount to 515. The facts of the 1938 hurricane. Peak steady winds of 121 miles per hour. Peak gusts, 186 miles per hour at Blue Hills Observatory. The lowest pressure, 27.94, I would argue that, at Bellport, New York. Peak storm surge, 17 feet above normal high tide in Rhode Island, I would argue that. Peak wave heights, 50 feet at Gloucester. Deaths, 700, 600 in New England alone. 63,000 homeless. 20,000 miles of power wire was knocked down. 8,900 homes and buildings are destroyed. 3,300 boats are lost. 26,000 automobiles are lost. 2 billion trees are destroyed. The cost in 1938 dollars is $6.2 million. That's about $15 billion in 1998. Shirley Ann Gatz is born at 3:28 p.m. at Eastern Long Island Hospital just as the roof blew off and flooded the delivery room. I had a man stand up at one of my lectures say I was born on that day because my mother, I was a preemie because of the low pressure. It induced his mother's pregnancy and induced his birth. There were other great Atlantic hurricanes in 44 that went up that. Edna in 54. Carol in 54 went up the Connecticut River Valley. Diane in 55. Donna in 60. The 1938 hurricane, one of the costliest in American history. Of course, Katrina has outdone every hurricane. So what happens when the Cyclops comes? And now, you people that have experienced it, know that there's going to be idiots that'll go get their beer and go down to the beach, or even more, the extreme surfers. Scientific studies have shown that a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread are not your best protection against a major storm. Check the tides and stay away from the beach. When they tell you to leave, you leave. Do not panic in a traffic jam. Shut off your engine to conserve fuel. That might be your home for a day or two. Know where the high ground is in your town and neighborhood. The winds are going to shift. Don't count on the wind blowing constantly in one direction. Always carry, if you can, clean drinking water. Stay away from downed power lines and, if possible, water containing downed power lines. Be aware that trees and houses can topple in an instant. Do not swim against the current. And if you're within 2 miles of the coast, you are vulnerable to storm surge. I like to say, if you act like a clown, you will drown. The blast zone, as I call it, in Boston. If a major hurricane were to strike Boston, you'd see flooding go into Medford, East Arlington, Watertown, where my home is, all the way down to Roslindale, Brookline. You can see it's just outside in Dorchester, Meeting House Hill, Neponset, just on the cusp of Milton. My resources: A Wind to Shake the World, Everett S. Allen, Michael Gramatico, Cherie Burns with a wonderful Great Hurricane 1938, Sudden Sea, R.A. Scotty, and Aram Gutsuzian, The Hurricane of 38. That's my talk for this morning. You've been a wonderful audience. Now I get to hear your stories. So if you want to raise your hand and we can throw the lights on, please. We're going to hear your individual tales. Thank you. You've been a great audience. Thank you. Okay, we'll start at this table over here. Ladies, anybody want to just tell me a brief story?
We went to school. We climbed over trees. I don't remember the classroom, but I remember the cafeteria. We had candles. No way would kids go to school today. But
sure.
And the cemetery was a disaster. Trees down everywhere.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. Do you remember it?
No.
Do you have a
We lived in Dorchester. We didn't realize it was a hurricane. Nobody knew those.
Right, right.
You were a street watching the trees come down.
Yeah, there's so many, as you know, New England's famous for its old trees, and there's so much lumber taken down. That lumber later, of all the trees that fell during the hurricane of 38, was used in the home building effort post-World War II, and it actually helped out our industry in World War II. And I like to tell people that in Marshfield, 1941, there was a great fire, and all those fallen trees made nice kindling wood during a dry season for a great fire to roar by. Does anybody have any recollections over here? Yes. Oh, yes. Oh. Tell me about it.
Oh, we were watching from the second floor of a big oak tree right beside our house. We were little kids, and it fell across the street. And we would, ooh. I mean, it was a tremendous oak, but it went right across the street and right down a driveway. Missed the house on both sides.
Wow. Wow.
We were up there yelling to my mother, she's come down, you could get killed.
Right, right. You didn't know. No. Nobody told you.
We were kids.
I was traveling on my way to my first day at Wellesley College. My sister had graduated from the college, and she knew the road and all that. And we drove from Philadelphia up through New England, and it kept getting worse and worse, and they dropped me at the dormitory and said, goodbye, we gotta leave. And so I was in a dorm that was in the center of Wellesley town. In those days, the college wasn't quite as big. And so I got my bicycle and started walking because we were supposed to gather up on the campus. And I walked with things coming down around me and the wind blowing until finally I turned around. But I just dodged back and forth to get home. And then worried about my mother and my sister. And it took them 9 hours to drive home from Wellesley to the outskirts of Philadelphia. But they got home safely. But all of that remains very vivid in my thinking as I dodged. I was scared to death. I had my bicycle with me. I couldn't let it go. It was brand new, you know, but I made it. And so I've never forgotten that.
Sure.
Yep.
Wonderful recollection. Yeah. Does anybody at this table have any recollections?
Yeah.
Yes.
I remember two things in that. My father was in Worcester on business. And we knew that he was coming home. I'm not sure whether I heard anything on the radio. And my sister and mother and I were just petrified. I mean, finally he came home, very calm and collected. He said, oh, it was all right. We just went from one side of the highway to the other, you know, to avoid trees. If there was a tree down on this side, we'd go on the other side. And secondly, we had a magnificent pear tree. The tree didn't go down, but every single pear was crushed. Right
oh.
Down.
Oh.
That's the only thing I remember.
And it did destroy a lot of great orchards in New England, absolutely.
All the pears were down.
Absolutely. Anybody else at this table?
Yes. I lived up on Highland Street, and across our driveway, which was a quarter of a mile long, 7 spruce trees came down.
Oh.
Yeah. And for ages, we didn't have any power. I was doing homework by candlelight.
Wow, wow. Huh. Does anybody have any recollections at this table?
Yes, I just wanted to say that I was 8 or 9 years old, and I remember standing at my back door with my mother, who was yelling, Jimmy Higgins, get in here. My dad, thought it would be a good idea to help Mrs. Sheehan next door with her rose bush. It was such her favorite. He was tying down a rose bush, and my mother was screaming at him, and as she did so, our garage, right next to my dad tying a rose bush, rose 18 inches, moved to the left, and went down again.
So
I do remember watching that garage move. My relatives from Horseneck Beach, they had a house right on the water. There was a death in our family, and all of the family had come to Fall River to go to the funeral. They were saved, but their house was not there when they returned. The story was that people who were saved at Horseneck Beach were able to climb a telephone post. If you could get up a telephone post and stay at the top, then when the water went down and you were still holding on, they were rescued.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. Right, exactly, exactly. Just, yes.
Oh, I have not anything as exciting as that. I was 7, and my sister and 2 brothers and I came out of the house and held onto the chain-link fence across the street. We had the cat and my uncle's bird, Peter, in the cage, swinging. We didn't know it was a hurricane. Mm. And the chimney toppled down.
Wow.
But we were there watching. Huh. 7.
Wow, wow. Yep. Does anybody else have a recollection that they... Yes.
I was 18 at that time, walking down the street in Manhattan.
Wow.
And I could see water. Nothing. There was no building damage, but all the signposts have come down. I remember that, you know, any markings of the streets are all down on the ground. We just had a terrific wind. This was on the East River in Manhattan. And that's all I remember. I was 18 at the time.
Wow, wow.
We had nothing really.
Sure, sure.
But then we heard of all the other disasters.
I just vaguely remember, but my house went through Katrina down in Ocean Springs.
Oh.
And so we had about 7 feet of water into the to the roof.
Oh.
But fortunately, I was on the Cape at the time.
Sure.
So I didn't, but it was a mess.
Oh,
it's and we had no water nearby. It was a tsunami. That's what it was.
Right. Exactly. It was just brought in right off the Gulf.
It came right in. So.
Absolutely. And people forget it's a storm surge that'll get you, not the wind.
It's a storm surge. Yeah. Right.
I was about 10 years old, and I lived in South Boston, and I was on M Street, and the water was right across the street, and the boats were coming right up my street. The water was so high, and we were standing at the window watching it.
God, what a
wow. Wow. Thank you.
Depends on where you were at the time.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that.